Well, some of you may be experts in one kind of plant, like roses or daylilies. Most of us have a little bit of everything in our gardens, plus maybe a lawn as well. Well, we're lucky to have such a great group of UW Extension horticulture educators in our state. They answer any and every type of question you can imagine, and they do it with a smile. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we have Sharon Morrissey with us. Sharon is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County, and she has lots of great information to share. Sharon, always great to have you on Garden Talk.
Well, I'm pleased to be here. Thanks very much.
Well, and here we are at the start of spring. It's an especially exciting time to be a gardener. And I also think that this time of year, we often hear from people who will be gardening for either the very first time or the first time in a long time, maybe since they were kids. Basic advice for new gardeners, I think, can also serve as a really great refresher for experienced gardeners as well. So let's start with some really basic basics. I'm guessing a lot of this info will also apply for vegetables or flowers. I think one thing that all of us can benefit from, Sharon, is knowing how large a garden to take on.
That is the very first thing I think of when I think of beginning gardeners, that they need to start small and don't take too much at a time, but have a plan, too. It's really important to develop that plan. It may take you the year to kind of develop it, and then don't do anything too permanent until you've got a plan of where things should go and what you want to plant, how you're going to use the different areas on your property. But I think the very first step you should take is to find out where you can get the resources from the UW Extension to help you along the way, because we have publications and fact sheets and websites that can really help to answer a lot of your questions.
And they can be questions for getting started. They can be questions as you go along. And there are so many publications in the Learning Store that really, even 10 years into gardening, I bet there's going to be a publication that will help you answer something.
Oh, definitely. And we have new ones coming out all the time mm-hmm. as well. For planning and designing the home garden, that is actually the name of a publication that can be really helpful if you've just acquired a property or even if you've decided to sort of redesign, to renovate. You know, we renovate our kitchens mm-hmm. and our bathrooms. Let's renovate our yards once it gets to a point where things just aren't working so well anymore and you're living with maybe some mistakes that were made before you purchased the property or since you've been there and you've learned that you now want to change things. That publication, Planning and Designing the Home Garden, is publication number G1923. And the learningstore.uwex.edu is our publication's website.
And we'll make sure we get that up on Facebook so people can find that easily. Kind of going along with how large a garden to consider taking on, also, you know, they say location, location, location. Where it's going to be is really important, too.
That is very true, and to know that site very well, to really observe what the sunlight is like in that site. Often I ask people if an area is in full sun or is it in shade, and they'll say, well, it's got sun, until about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, so it's got, you know, that's pretty full sun, but it really isn't.
Right.
And then, again, in the evening, those early morning hours and the late evening hours kind of don't count when you're a plant. So you're really gaining the most from the sun between, you know, say 9 o'clock until 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So full sun would be 6 to 8 hours during that period. And if you don't have that, you don't really have full sun. But you have to really observe it over the period, the course of the year, because as we know, the sunlight moves around.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, trees don't have their leaves
exactly.
on them. So the deciduous trees allow sunlight through, but later on, those areas would be shady. So that's one aspect of location. And another one, of course, is the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And now is a good time to be kind of out there tromping around and seeing what areas are still really squishy as everything else is starting to dry up. And that'll give you a little bit of an idea of where the wet areas are in your yard. And then just planting accordingly, choosing plants that can tolerate a little bit more moisture.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the sun for just a moment, I'm guessing that
yeah.
most vegetables need a lot of sun.
Absolutely. Okay. And there that the you can kind of make that as a blanket statement for vegetable gardens. Mm-hmm. Herbs, it's pretty much true for them too. There are a few exceptions to both. With vegetables, I think of the leafy salad greens mm-hmm. like lettuce and spinach can tolerate a little bit more shade. And in fact, a little later in the season when they don't like the heat in June, early June, you're still trying to finish off a crop, then that shade can be of an advantage, but definitely not full shade.
Mm-hmm. So talking about the location, you talked about, you know, what kind of soil is there, what kind of drainage. I have to say, from personal experience, it also helps if it's a place that you're going to remember to go to.
Absolutely. With a vegetable garden, we think about putting it way out as far away from the house as possible because you just don't want to have this vegetable garden to be, you know, a main feature right off your patio. And that's true, but it does need to be someplace that's relatively easy to get to or you're not going to go out there very often. And you've got to stretch a hose all mm-hmm. the way out there to get water out there. So that's very true, too. Put something out that far that you may want to look at that is more native plants that are suited to that site, plants that don't need as much attention and don't need as intense a cultivation.
And so more looking more at the actual soil itself, you know, we want to make sure that it drains well and that the sun is hitting it, but also the quality and the composition of the soil is really important as well.
Yeah, very few of us really have great soil unless we've been working at it for a while. In the southeastern part of the state, we have pretty heavy clay soils. They're high in pH. There are areas of the state that are very sandy, and they drain very, very quickly, so things dry out very fast. The forested soils are nicer. They have a lot of organic matter in them up in the northern and the whole northern band across the state, but those areas can be kind of shady. So the best bet for improving your soil, no matter what the condition it's in, is to add organic matter. Mm-hmm. Clay soils benefit from the addition of organic matter, and sandy soils do. So you can hardly go wrong by adding organic matter. Choosing the right organic matter, choosing something that's clean and well decomposed so it works into the soil well, especially if it's a vegetable garden where you're going to be planting some seeds. You need to have a good, fine, friable seed bed to plant those seeds into.
So they don't have to work too hard to get poke their heads through.
That's right.
And get their roots down.
That's right. And then also with the seed, you have to make sure that there's good contact between the seed and the soil. And if there's a lot of clods of soil, you'll have a lot of air spaces, and then the seeds will dry out, even if you're keeping it moist.
And so because we are really kind of trying to think of those brand new gardeners, you've said organic matter, but what falls under that category?
Well, compost is probably the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people. Compost that you've produced yourself or you can purchase. You can purchase it bagged. You can purchase it in bulk. You can also use composted leaves. So be thinking about what you're going to do with your leaves next fall if you haven't already composted your leaves. And composting doesn't have to be a difficult process. It can be chopping up and piling up organic matter that's produced by the garden and the yard throughout the season. And then, you know, within a period of a year and a half maybe, you'll have some pretty decent stuff you can put into the soil. But you can buy, like I say, bagged or bulk compost. You can use peat moss. Peat moss is not a sustainable product. It is mined. It's mined in Canadian sphagnum moss beds, fields, and then that is very, very slow to regenerate. You can use coir, C-O-I-R. It is coconut fiber, and it helps to provide airspace in the soil and allow good drainage, but also holds moisture. And that you can purchase and as a bagged product. So any organic matter that has been broken down to a certain extent can be added to the soil as organic matter.
We are talking with Sharon Morrissey. She is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. It is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in. We're talking about some of the basics of gardening. And if you're an experienced gardener, what advice would you share with someone just starting out? Maybe they can learn from your successes and, yes, even your failures. That would be great. Or if you're a brand new gardener, what do you need to know to feel like you're ready to dig in? We'd love to have you join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our on-air producer is Cheyenne Lenz. She is happy to take your calls and get them in through to us. And if you have any questions about something that did particularly well or not so well last year in your garden, Sharon is happy to answer those questions too. So, Sharon, we're talking about preparing the soil if we're actually planting in the garden, and that's important. Right. One thing that often comes up on Garden Talk is soil testing, and maybe you can say a little bit about that.
Yeah, soil testing is a good idea. It gives you kind of a baseline of where your soil's at when you start at this moment. You know, it's a snapshot of this point in time. And what you do is you collect some soil from an area that you have a particular purpose for, say the area where you're going to have a vegetable garden, or say you're planning to put in a new flower garden, a perennial garden, you're going to plant some trees, whatever. Those areas should all be tested separately, because the results that you get back will give recommendations for fertility for the areas depending upon what you plan to grow there or what's currently growing there. And to take the soil test, you simply need a shovel and a bucket. And we suggest that you take some random samples throughout the area, slicing down into the soil about 4 inches. And then that entire 4-inch depth, you want to get a slice of that and put it into the bucket. And do that in 5, 6, 7 locations around the area. And then mix all that together. And all you need is a cup of that to send in for a soil sample. And you can find out more about how to do that, where to send it, by going to our Soils Lab website. And the Soils Lab is, well, I guess they're still using the same website. I know they are planning on closing the site at West Madison. Mm-hmm. So the website is uwisc.edu.
All right, and we will get that up on the Facebook page. We also have a link up to the UW Extension Learning Store. I linked directly to the section that has lawn and garden publications, and it looks like there are 253 to choose from, so lots of great information there. Yeah. And so we're talking about, you know, preparing and testing soil in the actual garden, but of course, I think it's becoming more and more popular, and there's more and more interest in container gardening and raised beds. How different is it for what kind of soil you're using in those kind of structures?
Well, those are very different, actually, and it's one of the great reasons to garden in raised beds or in containers is that you can put in the best soil mix that you can afford, and it's going to be probably better than what you have in ground right now.
Right.
So, and it is easier to garden in containers. We consider container gardening to be sort of accessible gardening when you can't stoop over as well as you used to, or can't get down on your knees anymore. Raised beds work beautifully for that. All the way through having actual disabilities that make someone wheelchair bound, they can garden in containers and raised beds too. The soil that I would recommend for a raised bed, it can be purchased in bulk to be added to a raised bed. There are many companies around the state that offer various soil mixes. You want something that holds moisture, but also is well-drained, and that sounds sort of like it's at cross-purposes, but you can have moisture held on soil particles while the pores in the soil have oxygen in them. So that's the well-drained part, and that's the formula that most plants need for good growth. If you're preparing your own soil mix, or you're preparing your own soil mix for even small containers, there you can buy bagged products and add those, or you can make a mix. Now, kind of a standard one that's a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio, and that means one part of each of these three things, either compost or topsoil, vermiculite or perlite, and peat moss or core. If you mix, you know, one from each of those three categories, sort of like one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C, and mix those in pretty equal proportions, you'll have a pretty good soil mix. And that's good for raised beds because you can buy these things in pretty large bags or bales and mix them yourself, and it may be cheaper than purchasing soil from somewhere that's already mixed it. So the choice is yours in that case. And it's interesting that you ask about container gardenings because it is such a popular topic right now that our Master Gardener volunteers and the UW Extension in southeast Wisconsin in Milwaukee and Waukesha are having a display, a booth at our home show, the Realtors, Milwaukee Realtors Home and Garden Show, which starts today. In fact, it started at 10 o'clock this morning.
Oh, that's great.
And it runs through the 29th of March. And our Master Gardener volunteers will have a booth there, and it's all about container gardening. Lots of good ideas and suggestions. We have a new brochure to go with it. So if you're going to go to the home show, stop there and get one of our brochures and talk to our master gardeners.
Well, and I think one of the great things about containers is that you were talking earlier about making sure that the plot that you're thinking of using as your vegetable garden especially gets enough sun. Well, guess what? A container, you can move to wherever the sun is.
Exactly.
And also for people like me who have neighbors with black walnut trees, it's about the only way to grow things like tomatoes because I don't have to worry about the juggling in the black walnut roots affecting.
That's absolutely right. And you can move pots around during the day, have gardens where you couldn't have gardens before, like on patios or balconies. But you can also move them around as the sun moves around for the day.
Exactly.
So that's a real advantage.
We are talking with Sharon Morrissey. She's the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent from Milwaukee County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, UW Extension horticulture educator Diana Alfith is here to answer all of your gardening questions. That's next week at this time on Garden Talk. But today, we are happy to be talking with Sharon Morrissey. She is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. And we were talking a little bit about raised beds earlier, Sharon. And Tim on Facebook posted a picture. He says, here's the new raised bed at our new house. It's admittedly small, 8 by 8 feet, so I'm hoping your guest has suggestions for crops we can grow in a non-traditional place on our property.
That's a good question. An 8 by 8 raised bed is actually a pretty good size.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Yeah, they often make them 4 feet by 8 feet, but it still is not a huge area. It is big enough to do some pretty intensive gardening. A lot of the smaller crops like lettuce and spinach and radishes, even onions, can be grown very easily in an area like that. You can grow a tomato plant or two. You can grow a pepper plant or two. Maybe a broccoli plant. So you can squeeze quite a bit into that space. And one good way to do that is by using a method of gardening called square foot gardening.
That's what I was thinking as well.
Yeah, it was developed by Mel Bartholomew and has a book on it and a website. And what he did is to determine an exact spacing for all of the typical vegetable crops of how many you can fit into 1 square foot. So for something like radishes or carrots, you can put 16 in 1 square foot. For something like lettuce, if it's leaf lettuce and you want to grow individual plants of leaf lettuce, you can put 4, I don't know, maybe it's 6 in that one. He then takes larger crops like tomatoes and puts tomatoes into 2 square feet. I think they really need to have 4 square feet in order to provide enough air circulation between the plants. So I guess my only criticism of his methods are that things are very, very tight, especially when it comes to the larger plants. But you can really grow quite a bit in an 8x8 garden bed. The difficulty you're going to have is reaching into the middle of that. Mm-hmm. They usually say you should have your bed no wider than 4 feet so that from either side you can reach in about 2 feet. It's kind of hard to reach in 4 feet without stepping on the soil or stepping on other crops.
Maybe they'll have to get one of those grabber tools that extends your reach a little bit. But yeah. Also with the square foot gardening, there are a lot of suggestions for succession planting. So you might start out the season with one thing in that square foot or two, and then later in the season put something else in.
That, and you can plant, you know, when you're planting a tomato or a pepper or a broccoli plant, you start out with a very small plant. And if you're allowing, say, 4 square feet for this plant, you have a lot of empty space for quite a while, mm-hmm. early in the season. And that's when you can grow some of the smaller things, like lettuce and spinach and radishes and green onions. And those you can put in that area until the larger plant gets too large and shades out those crops, but those crops are pretty well done by then anyway.
Right.
So that's a great way to do a succession as well.
Let's go to the phones, and Annie in La Crosse is up first. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, this is great. I am all excited about straw bale gardening. I have my yard has become very shady over the years as my trees have gotten bigger, but I have lots of places where there is sun, but it's unavailable for regular planting. Mm-hmm. So is there an extension pamphlet about straw bale gardening? And I will take your answer when I hang up. Thank
all right.
you very much.
Thanks, Annie.
No, we do not have a UW Extension straw bale gardening publication, but there are other extension services around the country that have developed methods for doing straw bale gardening.
Well, and Joel Karsten, who wrote the straw bale gardening book, he's been on the show several times. I was just looking at the calendar. He was last on February 20th, so Amy could go back and listen to that program, and the book just got updated. There's actually some really good updates on it. Just for people who have not heard of straw bale gardening, Sharon, do you want to describe it a little bit?
Yeah, it's actually using straw bales as your medium to grow the plants in. You set them up on end, and after some processing that involves a lot of nitrogen to start to break down the straw, then you plant directly into the bale. And you can do it with transplants that you dig a little hole or open up a portion of the bale and you stick the transplant in. Or you can do it with seed by actually putting a couple of inches of soil on top of the bale and then planting into that. And as the roots develop, they go down into the bale. The conditioning process is what's so important mm-hmm. with straw bale gardening. But you can make huge gardens, or you can just put a couple of bales out and grow some things in them, depending on what space you've got. But you can grow almost everything in a straw bale. I think the only exception is probably corn.
Yeah, and Joel also says, and this is kind of common sense, that perennial crops like, say, rhubarb or, you know, a right. fruit bush or something is not the best choice, since the bale does eventually break down. But as far as annual vegetables, yeah, other than corn, which might tip over its bale, everything else I think does pretty well. I think what's also really appealing, and people don't necessarily think about it, is that there's one side of the bale that's on the ground, but you can plant in all the other sides. So you can actually plant on 5 surfaces. So you can have trailing vegetables going out the sides and then things on the top. And so it's actually for a pretty small area, surface area, you can get a lot out of even a single bale.
Yes, it can be a really intensive garden in, like you say, even a single bale. That conditioning process, I think the recommendation is to use urea, something that's very high in nitrogen, and sprinkling on the bale. You go through a process of, I think, 11 to 14 days long of adding various amounts of it, watering it in real well. And what you're doing is starting the decomposition process on the interior of the bale. It heats up the bale on the inside, and then that provides a really good rooting zone for the crops when you transplant them into the bale. I've grown even potatoes in a straw bale, and I found that they worked out beautifully. It was great fun to reach in there at the end of the season and, you know, root around with your hand and find these big, beautiful potatoes. And since they're not growing in the ground, they have very little resistance. They don't have dirt on them. They really are beautiful when you take them out of the bales.
Let's go back to the phones and Lynn in Milwaukee. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I have a question that goes back to your preparing the soil. When we were kids, our parents took the ash from the wood-burning fireplace and threw it on the garden, in, you know, all through the winter, and of course, they didn't use the fireplace in the summer. And I didn't know if that's just because that's the only place they had to put it or if it's actually good for the soil. And now we have a wood-burning fireplace and all of this leftover ash, and I don't know what to do with it.
Well, I really can't tell you what to do with it. I'm not real sure what the best use for it is, but I know it is not in your vegetable garden or your garden beds, particularly if you're living in Milwaukee, because our soils are so alkaline, and that wood ash is quite alkaline, and you will raise the pH of your soil so drastically that you probably will limit what you can grow in it. So you can add a little bit of it, but not large quantities. In other parts of the state, you may be able to get by with using more of it in a garden, but if you've been doing it for a while and you find that you are having trouble growing things, you may want to take a soil test and find out what the pH of that soil is, and then you may have to use something to amend the soil to lower the pH as a result.
So if you've got soil that is in a high pH,
yes,
you want to use the ash?
No, you don't, because it makes it even higher.
Okay, so a low pH, you could add the ash. And would that be, what do pine trees create?
Well, pine trees do create a lower pH soil, but still, it usually is around 6.0 to 6.5, which is the ideal range for growing the most crops or the most plants. Most plants like a pH of that range. So if you're going to start adding wood ash to it, even then it could raise it very well up over that 6.5. Once you get to 7, it's considered neutral, but in the world of gardening and plants, 7 is really quite alkaline because they do prefer to have soil at about 6 to 6.5.
And Sharon, are most vegetables kind of in that kind of standard range of what they like? I know things like blueberries have much more specific needs,
exactly.
but the annual vegetables pretty standard pH demands.
Yep, they do like a pretty standard pH of 6 to 6.5. You can grow, obviously, we grow vegetable gardens quite nicely in higher pH soils, so they are somewhat forgiving. But I think one of the exceptions to this rule is potatoes, and they find that potatoes have fewer disease problems if they're grown in a higher pH soil. So that, you know, you don't really need to amend your soil and make it a higher pH. If you were a potato grower, you would definitely control the pH to control diseases. But otherwise, most vegetables, 6 to 6.5.
All right, thanks for that call, Lynn. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or garden photo. We always love those on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. We talked a little bit that containers will dry out faster than a garden plot that's actually in the ground. But let's talk a little more about watering, Sharon, because that's such a key part of successful gardening. What are some good guidelines for watering? And I'm going to put it out there. I think that is why I'm not as successful a gardener as I would like to be, because I'm just not that good at, about watering.
Yeah, it's hard to do. It takes time, and you know, you can water with a garden hose that you direct right down to the base of the plants. My favorite is using a watering wand and to water right onto the soil where the plants can pull up that water through the roots. It is the way they get most of their water. Or you can use overhead sprinklers. With overhead sprinklers, however, you're getting the leaves wet, and wet leaves, if there are going to be disease problems, it's leaf moisture that those diseases need in order to infect the plant. So keeping the leaves dry is a strategy that we use to prevent diseases, particularly with things like tomatoes mm-hmm. that are so prone to leaf spot diseases anyway. Watering, the kind of general rule of thumb is the 1 inch per week, and that's whether it comes from rain or from you, from your garden hose. But if you're getting only an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch several days during a week, it's really not accumulating to an inch because it evaporates mm-hmm. off the soil surface so much. You need to have a good inch at a time to get the depth and to get it to penetrate. In a kind of a heavy soil, a clayish soil, an inch of water will penetrate about 4 inches deep. And that's deep enough for many of our crops, and it's held deep in the soil for a little longer than it is at the surface. But a good deep watering is what most plants need, about once a week.
And so how do we know that it's been an inch of watering?
Well, if you're using an overhead sprinkler, it's easy because you can put a can out, a straight-sided vessel of any kind, even your rain gauge, and collect the water that comes from your sprinkler. When you've collected an inch, you've put an inch of water over the entire area. But if you're not using an overhead sprinkler, if you're watering right down at the base of the plant, the only way to really know is to take a trowel and dig down a little bit after you've watered for a period of time, by hand holding it to the ground, and then see how much has penetrated. It's kind of deceiving. I know even with a well-drained garden bed, when you water it, the whole soil surface can look wet, but if you dig down just an inch or so, you'll find that it's dry underneath that top layer. It doesn't penetrate until you've provided quite a bit of water. And then to hold water, using a mulch is really helpful. It can really reduce the watering requirement. So for those who don't get around to it that often, mulch can save your crops.
What do you think of soaker hoses?
Soaker hoses are a great idea. They work really well. You can lay them down, especially if you have a row crop, or even in a flower garden bed where you can kind of twine it through the bed, twist it and snake it through the garden bed so that it comes close to the roots of the plants you're growing in there. They have soaker hoses that have holes on one side. They're flat and have holes on one side. Turn those upside down so that the holes are directed to the ground rather than up into the air. Like we used to use them back when we were mm-hmm. kids. Our parents all put them the other way around on the grass and watered the grass with them, but they work better the other way around in a garden bed. Or you can get the kind of hose that is sort of weeps. It's pervious, and so as the water runs through it, it just slowly leaks into the soil. Those work fine, too. And drip irrigation systems using those kinds of hoses and then maybe even tubing that leads directly to individual plants can really be a time saver and a water saver.
Because there's less evaporation? Is that part of it?
Exactly, mm-hmm. yeah.
So I have a question for you. This is to prove that even though I can host Garden Talk, I certainly don't know all the answers. I bought a new hose just a year or two ago, and it must have had a defect because it cracked. It bent and cracked very mm-hmm. in the first season, and of course I hadn't saved the receipt, and so I'm here I am stuck with this very good condition hose except in that one little spot, and I'm wondering, could I somehow turn that into a soaker hose? Could I poke some holes along the way and just run the water through it really, really slowly and make it into a soaker?
You might be able to, but if it's one part, one area that's cracked or broken, you can also repair that by cutting out the cracked portion or the bent portion. And then there are little kits that have the hardware for the ends to make them connect back together again. I've not heard of taking a hose and putting holes in it to make it into a soaker hose, but it might work.
Maybe I should just do it for the greater good so we can report back
exactly.
on whether it works or not.
You have an opportunity there.
Exactly. We are talking with Sharon Morrissey. She is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Happy to have Sharon Morrissey with us. And Sharon, let's go back to the phones, and Larry in Dallas is up. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Yeah, this is Larry from Dallas, Wisconsin.
Hi.
That's kind of a two-part question here. How much can you pick off of your rhubarb plant during its growing season, and then when's the time to stop? Because I've heard that you could get sick by eating it too late in the season.
Both good questions, Larry. Sharon, what do you think?
Yeah, that is a really good question. Both of those questions are, you can harvest up to about half of the total amount of leaves, number of leaves that are produced by rhubarb in a season. And they generally say you should stop around the beginning of July at the very latest. And there's a couple of reasons for that, but neither of them have anything to do with poisoning. But there is that issue with rhubarb later in the year when there has been a frost. Once there's been a hard freeze, the oxalic acid, which is produced in the leaves of rhubarb, migrates down the stems, and there, then those stems do contain the oxalic acid, which can be poisonous. So that's when you stop harvesting completely. You never harvest after you've had a hard frost. As far as earlier in the season, you stop so that the plant can put more energy down into its root system and rejuvenate itself for next year and prepare for next year so it can build up on carbohydrates. That's the reason that you stop early in July. And also because in early in July, some of those stems have gotten pretty large and pretty tough, mm-hmm. and all the fibers in the stems become kind of woody. And I made the mistake once of picking a little too late, thinking, oh, I'll pick some young stems and they'll be fine. Cut them all up, made a wonderful rhubarb dessert, and there were little tiny sticks of these fibers throughout the whole thing. So it was pretty inedible.
Lesson learned.
Exactly.
So what if it's a relatively new plant? Maybe it's on its second or third year. Do you want to harvest a little less heavily?
Well, second or third year. Third year is probably fine.
Okay.
Second year, yeah, you probably would want to go a little bit lighter. Definitely the first year, you harvest just enough for a taste
mm-hmm.
because you've been so anxious.
Exactly.
Now, that's not like with asparagus. Asparagus, you do need to wait several years. Probably the fourth year is when you can finally harvest a full harvest of asparagus. You really do have to wait a little longer. But rhubarb is a really vigorous plant, mm-hmm. and it does develop a good hardy root system and a full root system. And in fact, sometimes you need to dig and divide that root system. Good luck. It's hard to do. It forms a very large clump, crown down in the base, but they can get really, really crowded in there too.
Sounds good, Larry. My mouth is watering thinking about rhubarb season. Let's go back to the Let's go back to the phones and Patrick in Superior. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about fertilizer.
All right.
I have access to some very old horse manure. Is it usable, or are there still seeds living in it? Or
no, very old horse manure is like gold.
I was going to say, you might not want to say where you live because people
right.
will be knocking on your door.
Oh, wonderful. It's good to 5-6 years old, at least.
Oh, yeah. So, that's perfect. Horse manure is just, it's wonderful stuff because it contains so much organic matter. And if it's composted for a while, I think they say you only need to really compost it for a year to take care of the weed seeds in it or anything else. But it's just wonderful stuff. So, yeah, go ahead and use it.
When you say compost now, does that mean just leaving it in the manure pile?
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Uh-huh.
That works quite well. It decomposes. It can also be added fresh to a compost pile that would then be turned, and you would not use that compost pile for a while. And the reason you don't use it any fresher, mostly for two reasons. One is because it has so much nitrogen in it that nitrogen can burn the roots of plants. So putting fresh cow manure or horse manure or chicken manure around plants is not a great idea, or working it into the soil is not a great idea. And the other is that with horse manure and cow manure, you can end up with bacteria in the fresh manure that hasn't broken down and is still viable. And if any of that bacteria is on the leaves or the produce that you're eating, it can be it can make you sick. Mm,
that's a good point. But enjoy that old horse manure, because like Sharon said, that's about the best you can have for your garden. Thanks for that call. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. We have some open lines, and Cheyenne, our on-air producer, will be happy to get you ready to go and ask your question of Sharon. If you're a new gardener, what do you need to know? Are you itching to get out there but not quite sure where to start? Sharon is happy to help. And if you're an experienced gardener, we'd love to hear what you've learned over the years. Again, 800-642-1234. Amy on Facebook says, does Sharon have any good suggestions for plants that do well in shade? Our yard is mostly shaded for most of the day, but we'd still like to plant some flowers or something.
Shade is challenging because you're not going to end up with that lovely kind of English cottage garden appearance with lots of blooming plants in a shade garden.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty is more subtle. The beauty is more from the foliage and the shape of the plants than it is from the flowers. Using annual flowers, you can add that spark of color to a shade garden, but the perennial plants are more there for their foliage. There are definitely exceptions to that. A stilbe is a flowering shade plant. They need to have very moist soils that cannot be allowed to dry out, but they can tolerate quite a bit of shade, and they make sort of a plume type mm-hmm. flower on the top. There are large ones that are a couple of feet tall and small ones that are 6 inches tall, and the plumes can be purple or red or white or cream color, coming at different times of the year. So that's a good choice for shade, as long as it's moist shade. There are also all of the ligularias. I'm trying to think what the common name is for ligularia. But they have a rosette of leaves that comes up from a main crown. Many stems come up, long leaf stems, and then the leaf itself is rounded, or it may be more pointed and have some serrations on the leaves. They come in different leaf colors, so a dark purple on one side and a lighter color on the other side. And then later in the season, they do send up a flower spike. There's one called the Rocket that has a spike-type flower that grows 3 or 4 feet tall and has maybe 6 to 12 inches of flowers in the spike that are yellow. And the other ones also form a spike, but at the top of that are flowers that are a little bit more like sunflowers or daisies that are yellow.
Oh, nice.
And so that's a good one, too.
Also, if someone is looking for native plants, looking at things that grow in woodlands would probably tolerate some shade.
Very definitely. Our native woodland plants are good for shade. so violas mm-hmm. and Jack in the Pulpit.
I love Jack in the Pulpit.
And the geranium is another one, not the annual geranium that makes the big puffy balls of flowers, but the perennial geranium that has flowers that are born on top of the foliage in smaller clusters. Mm-hmm. Those are very nice in foliage. They're more of a ground cover plant.
Right.
They can grow up to maybe a foot tall and then have the flowers above that. Sometimes you'll have flowering early in the season and then sporadically throughout the season. Flowers can be pinkish or white. There's also a blue variety of geranium called Roxanne. That was a perennial plant of the year several years ago. Yeah, that one needs a little bit more sun, but it still can live in partial shade. So that's a good way to add some color to a shady spot. The ferns are a good choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sedges for grasses. We are learning that the ornamental grasses are such a nice addition to our garden.
Mm-hmm.
The sedges are wonderful because they have the grass-like foliage, but most of them like moisture soil and some shade, which is the exact opposite of our ornamental grasses.
Right.
They have to have very sunny, kind of hot, dry locations.
And let's go back to the phones and Leslie in Tomahawk. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I just have a comment. The woman that called in about putting the wood ash on her garden.
Yes.
Years ago, I live up in Tomahawk, and my parents also did also. And my dad always had the best, beautiful, most gorgeous garden ever. And one year, he put the wood ash on his garden at the end of, must have been the spring or maybe the fall before. But his garden was never, ever the same again.
Mm.
And it had to have been the wood ash. I don't know how much he put in. I don't think a whole lot because they only burned wood a little bit. But I guess I would just caution the lady just to be careful because he never was able to get that garden back to where it was.
Oh.
So just a little comment.
Yeah, that's the learning from past mistakes, right, Sharon?
Yes, exactly. And that is a good testimonial that sometimes it can be that obvious that one thing is what caused the problem.
Well, thank you so much, Leslie, for sharing that. And sorry that you have that knowledge, but glad you're able to share it with the rest of us. Betsy in Germantown is up next. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question with regard to the inoculants that get used when you're planting peas and beans. If you're only planting a few, then you've got this huge bag or, decent-sized bag of stuff left over. Can that be preserved from season to season? I notice that the bags do come dated.
And first of all, Sharon, why don't you explain what inoculants are?
Yeah, the inoculants are actually bacteria that work with the root systems of leguminous plants, and those are anything in the pea and bean family. So for vegetable crops, it's peas and beans, but there are lots of flowers and stuff that are legumes as well, and some trees and things. But usually we would use inoculants that are this bacteria that come in a granular form that you then apply to the soil at the time of planting the seed. And then that helps those seed form more of the root nodules that help to fix nitrogen in the roots of the plant. So it helps to improve the fertility of the plant, and then you don't need to add fertility. And then leaving those roots in the ground can add that nitrogen and fertility to that area of the soil for the coming year. The inoculants, after all of that explanation, I'm sorry that I can't tell you whether or not you can use those and they stay viable for 1, 2, 3, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
That would be something that I would want to look up, and I think if you were to contact the company, that might be the most reliable information you're going to get. Otherwise, I do want to make a mention of the best way to do a search for good university
mm-hmm.
research-based information on the Internet, and that is that when you're typing in whatever you're trying to get information about, and in this case it would be root inoculants for bean seeds
mm-hmm.
or legume seeds, and then after that phrase, leave a space and then type site, S-I-T-E, colon.edu.
Oh, so it limits it.
Yeah. All the sites that then come up from that search will be EDU sites, and you'll find that many of those are extension sites, and that then would be university research-based information. So that's how I would look that up.
Wow. So whatever you're looking for, so in this case, inoculants, PBean, and then site, S-I-T-E, colon, dot E-D-U, and that will limit the search to only university resources.
That's right.
Wow. Oh, that's a really powerful tool. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Betsy, hopefully that will help you narrow down, or as Sharon said, contact the manufacturer. We had a Facebook question from Tammy. She says, last year was the first time I had tomato blight. It's my understanding it's now in my soil forever. Will I ever be able to grow tomatoes again? Is there something special I should do to my soil?
Oh, tomatoes and tomato blight. There's no one disease that's called a tomato blight. There are lots of leaf spot type diseases. There are a couple of root soil-borne diseases that you can get on tomatoes. There is the dreaded late blight, which just totally wipes out your tomato crop. So it depends on which one you're talking about to a certain extent. The two soil-borne ones are Fusarium and Verticillium, and those do stay in the soil for a very long time, unfortunately. And as long as you grow tomatoes in those areas that are infected, they will probably be infected with those blights. But there are resistant varieties that you can choose to grow that are somewhat resistant to Fusarium and Verticillium.
And would those be more hybrids than, say, heirlooms?
Yeah. Yes, very definitely. And that is one of the things that they have bred for in tomatoes, is that resistance. So there are those soil-borne ones that do last for a very long time. Then there are the leaf spot diseases. Early blight and septoria are the two main ones that you get almost every single year, because the spores for those are pretty much everywhere. And they're blown in on the wind. They are, you know, just in the area, and some come with the plant. They just are everywhere.
So a lot to consider there, and always great information from Sharon Morrissey. She's the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. We always enjoy when she joins us on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Growing plants, whether indoors or out, really helps to connect us with nature. And as spring is starting to show itself, I can just feel gardeners all over the state itching to get out and play in the dirt. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sharon Morrissey is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County, and as always has lots of great information to share. Sharon, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
It's always so much fun to talk with you. And it's always so much fun to talk with our listeners. And we have wide open phone lines, so I hope they will fill those up shortly at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Did you have some spectacular successes or some horrible failures last year in your garden? Sharon is happy to help you figure out what happened so you can either do it again or avoid it this time around. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we had a question, let's see here, from Judy on Facebook. She says, can you offer any advice for reading a soil test result? She had one years ago and she didn't find it that helpful.
Yeah, they are a little bit confusing. Our soils labs have been working over the years to make them much more user-friendly and easier to understand. The basic things you're going to find out is, because you've told them what crop you're going to grow in that area, whether it's lawn or flowers or vegetables, all being crops, they will tell you how much nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium you need to add in the form of a fertilizer. And it'll give you some recommendations on the kinds of fertilizers to use. Sometimes those recommendations are in the form of lawn fertilizer, even if it is an area that you're not growing grass in. But that's because those are fertilizers that often have either very high nitrogen or they have higher phosphorus content or a higher potassium content, and you can kind of regulate them a little bit more than you can with other fertilizer products. The other thing you're looking for in a soil test report is the pH of the soil, just so you know what the pH is, and if it is anything above 7 or above, you're going to find that that's considered kind of alkaline, and anything you can do to lower the pH may make some of your plants grow better. You'll also find out kind of an estimate of soil texture. I think they're still doing that. And that tells you whether the soil is a loamy soil, a clayey soil, a loamy clay, a clayey loam, a sandy soil. But that gives you a little bit of an idea about that. So I would recommend that you get another soil test done so that you can get one of the newer reports that will tell you a little bit in more detail about what to do with your soil in its condition.
And Jerry in Madison wondered if you have a suggestion, Sharon, for an indoor plant that needs relatively low light. We talked about shade plants outdoors. Jerry wants one indoors. And whether you would suggest going to a big box store or to go to more of a specialty plant store.
Well, you can certainly find good plants in either of those locations, and there's a whole range of places that you can purchase indoor plants. What you're looking for are things that tolerate low light, and unfortunately, sometimes those things they sell as houseplants really don't do well unless you've got supplemental lighting. Even a bright, sunny southern window doesn't have as much sun as it may seem like it has inside, because you lose so much with the sun coming through the glass. So some of the recommendations, you know, there are the kind of the tried and trues. We have the corn plants, which are very common in malls and commercial office buildings. And, you know, that might be a good place to look. You may not know the name of the plant, but when you see those plants in those settings, those are usually the things that tolerate low light conditions. So corn plant is one of them. There are dracaenas that can tolerate low light conditions. The pothos is a great vine. It's the one, or devil's ivy. It's the one that has the variegated foliage, heart-shaped leaf, and the foliage is both a pale green and cream color or white variegation. There are
I have a Schefflera ferns. That does amazingly well in my windowless office.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, Schefflera's are considered kind of a medium to high light plant, so you must be getting a lot of light. And you know, in an office, you think, well, you've got the lights on, and so it's brighter in there. But unless you've got the plant up close to the light, it's really not getting a lot of that light. It really diffuses quite a bit. But, you know, sometimes you just find that right location for the right plant, and it's happy in its spot, and then it's like, don't mess with it, you know, except that thing's going to do okay. Fig trees are another good one for indoors in low-light conditions. The Sansevierias, the snake plant with the long, real thick, leathery leaves, jade plants. So there really are quite a few to choose from.
All right. And, you know, look at the label. They should say that they're low light or high light. So at least you have a good head start. We had an email from Kate that's interesting. She asks if fragments of lead paint may have gotten into the soil, is it still possible to plant herbs and vegetables, or will there be harmful uptake into the plant and contamination of the edibles?
Well, it's not as much an issue of it being taken up into the plants as it is your exposure to it while you're working
while
with
you're
the
gardening.
Soil.
Okay.
Yes. So both things are issues with soil that contains lead typically from old lead-painted structures in the area. So it would be recommended to plant in containers or raised beds in that situation.
Or a straw bale.
Or a straw bale. Exactly.
So we'll go back to the phones in just a moment. But this question on Facebook just tickled me. So I want to read it. Gracie says, I have Nigerian dwarf goats in Spring Branch, Texas. I'm wondering if I can use their cute berries as fertilizer and direct sow into my flower garden. And she says, I sure miss living in Wisconsin. I just want to see those dwarf goats.
I know. They must be so cute.
So
they're real characters, I understand.
Yeah. So she wants to know if she can use the direct fertilizer immediately into a flower garden. What do you think of that? Or should it be composted first, Sharon?
I'm not real sure how much it has to be composted. I know kind of the general rule of thumb is that you should compost manure before putting it into the soil. I don't know how high it is in nitrogen, and it is the combination of both nitrogen and the contaminant bacteria that you're composting to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
So that one, too, I'm not real familiar with goat manure.
Well, and with the bacteria, I mean, certainly you don't ever want to have exposure, but does it make a little bit of a difference if it's in a flower garden as opposed to a vegetable, maybe?
Yeah, definitely.
I would say try it in a little corner and see how
it works. Right. Don't go crazy with it, but try it in an area and see what happens.
And send us a picture of those goats. That's the most important thing.
You know, with perennial flowers, you don't really need to add a lot of fertilizer. And so, you know, you don't want to overdo it. If you use too much nitrogen fertilizer, you can stimulate more leafy growth and less floral growth, less blooming.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can kind of prevent blooming by putting on too much nitrogen.
Mm.
So do be kind of careful with that, or you'll have just leafy stuff.
All right. Patty in Hayward is up. Hi, Patty.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I've got a question for you.
Sure.
With this unseasonably warm weather, it's 46 degrees in Hayward today, when can I divide daylilies? Should I still be waiting till May?
No, you don't need to. You can divide them as soon as they start to come up, because you've got the clumps, you've got them in our area, they are starting to emerge, and you can take that clump and divide the whole thing and put it back into the ground. You still will have flowers this year, and now is a good time to do it because you're not damaging any of the foliage that's there. So as long as you can work at the soil, and what keeps you out of the soil and the conditions that you should not work in the soil are wet conditions. So if it is wet, don't do it.
And why is that, Sharon?
And that's because when you work soil that's wet, you actually destroy the root, the soil structure, and that ends up forming these hard, rock-hard clods that are like concrete, and you can barely break them up with a hammer. They're so hard.
Wow.
And they stay that way for an entire season or more.
Oh, wow.
And they need to break down, and the soil needs to kind of regain its original structure over a period of winter at least, if not more. So don't work soil when it's wet.
All right. That's great information, especially since we probably will get some spring rains coming up in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, good and bad.
Let's go next to Judy in Eau Claire. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I was wondering, with my tulips that are coming up, if it gets cold again, should I offer them some protection?
You can. I mean, if we're going to get a really, really hard freeze and you've got quite a bit of green leafy growth up, to prevent that portion of the leaf from turning brown, you can sprinkle a little bit of mulch on it, you know, shredded bark or some straw or something light, just enough to, or you can put a floating row cover on them. But generally, the spring flowering bulbs are very, very hardy because this is what they're adapted to. They're
mm-hmm.
adapted to a springs where they start to come up and then we get a freeze, and then they grow some more and then we get a freeze. And you're not going to probably hurt the flowers until the flower buds are up, and if the flower buds are up and we get a good hard freeze, yeah, then you might lose the flowers. Won't kill the plant, though.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Judy. What are some of the first spring bulbs that start blooming, Sharon?
Well, I think in most people's yards, the crocus are the ones mm-hmm. that start coming on first. But I was at Berner Botanical Gardens yesterday, and they have winter aconite up, which is Aranthus hyamalis, and it is one of our minor bulbs. They are little buttercup-type yellow flowers, and then they sort of have this little collar of a green lacy little collar underneath that is the leaves. So there's that little platform of leaf and this yellow flower sitting on top of it. And they're tiny, but they spread and make large clumps, and they're just so bright and cheery first thing in the spring.
I think I saw my hyacinths coming up. Would that make sense?
That's possible. Yeah, it's possible for any of those spring flowering things to start sending their leaves up, very definitely.
They're up against pretty close to the house, so I'm thinking that they're in a slightly warmer microclimate right there.
Exactly. That is the place that you will see those early emergers, too. So it's a nice place to plant some of those spring flowering bulbs, because then you'll have them coming up early in the season out farther in the yard where it doesn't have that protection and the warmth of the soil. It'll take a little longer for them to grow.
We had an email from Lele in Appleton. She says, I'm a new gardener. I'm wondering if I need to trim the perennials I planted last year, and if so, how much do I need to trim them down? She says, also, what about grapevines, blueberry and raspberry plants? When do I start cutting them down if, in fact, it's needed?
Well, those are two different situations, because the berries, the grapes, the raspberries, those are all woody branches, and they all kind of have different pruning requirements depending on what kind they are. Grapes are very different from raspberries. Mm-hmm. Black raspberries are very different from red raspberries. But definitely spring is the time. Now, before the buds start to swell and expand, is the time to prune all of those things. As far as cutting back your perennials, what you're cutting back is all the tissue that died over the winter. The tops die down, but new growth is going to come from the crown. And generally speaking, you can cut all your perennials all the way down to the ground, and new growth comes from the crown each year. Now, there are some exceptions with that, but as a general rule with perennials, you cut them all the way down to the ground.
And I think what I would recommend to Lele is looking at the UW Extension Learning Store site, because I know that there are some wonderful fruit publications there.
Oh, the fruit publications are great. And yes, there's a great publication, Growing Grapes in Wisconsin, Growing Raspberries in Wisconsin, and that will include black raspberries, purple raspberries, red and yellow raspberries, ever-bearing raspberries versus summer-flowering raspberries. So, definitely check out those publications.
All right, good luck with that, Lele, and we'd love to hear how your first full season goes. Let's go back to the phones and Jerry in Johnson Creek. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question regarding a garden that I started about 6 years ago. Just dug an area out of our yard. It's probably 20 by 25. And the soil was horrible. I don't think I saw one worm in it. And so I took cow manure, composted cow manure, and peat moss, and some other ingredients, and tried to amend the soil as best I could. Now I have a really nice looking soil, lots of worms in it whenever I dig. I do add compost to that every year also. For a mulch, I use just the cheapest wood mulch that I can find. The problem that I'm having is a couple of years ago, had two currant bushes in there, and they were getting what looked to be a rust, and it was just horrible on the bushes. Now, last year, we had tomatoes, Brussels sprouts. We still have horseradish in the garden, and when I planted the tomatoes, it didn't take long after the fruit came that every single leaf had been depleted off of the tomato bushes, and it still kept some fruit, so I was able to get some of that. But it looked like a blight on the tomato bushes, but it was also the currants were horrible. I ended up ripping one of the bushes out because it was so ugly. And even the Brussels sprouts, I didn't get anything off of the Brussels sprout bushes at all. They were just tattered. And even the horseradish leaves looked very tattered by the end of the summer. And I thought, gee, do I have some kind of disease throughout the soil?
Let's see what Sharon thinks.
This is an excellent example of a situation where you know you've been treating an area in one way, and then everything you're growing seems to have a problem. And so we tend to think that it's something that you that has happened because of what you've done, but also that it's the same thing affecting all of those crops. And in this case, it definitely is not. And it is not because of what you did to the soil. Mm. So you have good soil, and that's the good news. The currants have a blight they get. They get rust, and that rust makes them look awful by about the middle to the end of the summer, and they often just do that every year. You can select resistant varieties to plant that don't get as much rust. You'll still have some rust, but that's one disease of that particular plant. It doesn't spread to anything else that you're growing. The tomatoes that you're growing, almost everybody's tomatoes have leaf spot diseases every year. Mm-hmm. And so you need to grow those plants in a way to keep the leaves dry, to keep the fungus that's specific to tomato from infecting the tomatoes. The Brussels sprouts you're growing, you said that those were tattered. That's because Brussels sprouts are in the cole crop mm-hmm. family. That family has a complex of three different caterpillars that chew on the foliage. And so you probably have had those small caterpillars chewing on the foliage, and each Brussels sprout, as they chew, it's like paper dolls, you know. The whole Brussels sprout ends up looking tattered and worn. So that's probably what's going on with your Brussels sprouts. And the last thing you have is horseradish, and I would... You will hope that you could kill it with some blight. Because horseradish is something that once you have it forever. And it kind of spreads and gets larger. And you think you've cut out the entire root, and you haven't. You never will. So be careful with horseradish, where you plant it and how you take care of it. You can't hurt it. Nothing can hurt it. It doesn't have any diseases or insects that will eat it. So the horseradish you probably will have no problem with in the future. You know, you'll still have the root that you can use.
So
that's a great example.
Yeah, that we assume that it's all one thing. Yes,
it happens a lot.
All right.
And it's understandable. But fortunately, our insect and disease problems for our plants are pretty host-specific. Mm-hmm. There are some generalists, but most things are pretty host-specific. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to grow anything.
Thanks for that call, Jerry. And thanks for being a good kind of case study there. Lynn in Lake Forest, Illinois, had wax begonias that were pulled out by chipmunks. Is there anything to prevent that?
Can you shoot in your neighborhood? No. you have to put some chicken wire down or something, or something that with that wax begonias is going to be hard. The chipmunks are going to pull them out, and there's not much you can do to keep them in. You can use repellents that are taste repellents or smell repellents, where they smell it and they don't go near that area, or taste repellents where they take a couple bites and then decide they don't want to eat them anymore and they'll leave them alone. People have this problem with bulbs, spring flowering mm-hmm. bulbs a lot of time. You plant them in the fall, and then all the squirrels dig them up,
yes.
or the chipmunks will dig them up. That you would put chicken wire down for. Wildlife is one of the big challenges that we all have. We love certain parts of it, and other aspects of wildlife we need to control.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just at the beginning or the end of a season, it's right all the way through. Those chipmunks they seem to like to take one bite out of every tomato. I'd be happy to give them one whole big tomato. I just wish they wouldn't have to taste every single one. It's more than frustrating. Well, Sharon, in just the last 30 seconds or so, is there, you said, things like dividing daylilies, if you can get in the ground, do it. Is it too early to plant things like early peas or maybe radishes or something like that?
Well, it may be a little bit early, but, you know, if you're not putting your entire crop in and you're not putting a lot of money into it, mm-hmm. it's always worth a try. If you can get into the garden, those real early season things, lettuce, spinach, the kale crops, peas, definitely. And it's worth giving it a try. And then if you have a really, really hard freeze and kills it off, well, then you just plant later
over.
Like you would have anyway.
Start over. Sharon Morrissey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much. It's my pleasure.
Sharon Morrissey is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk.